We tend to think of the CIA and the Office of Strategic Services as the beginning of intelligence in the United States, and that really is not the case. I think there was perfect support for it, but there was also an undercurrent of a feeling that this was an un-American kind of thing to do, to spy.
A book signing will follow today's forum, so at the end, please let Fred escape without too much holding on to him. You know, it's when you have a rock star like that, I know the temptation is overpowering. I know there are no guilty parties here, but from time to time, we have had people who, during the Q&A session, have used this as an opportunity to deliver a lengthy statement. And we want, yes, that's happened. So please do take the opportunity to ask questions, but remember the rule on Jeopardy. It has to be in the form of a question. I mentioned that we are in the process of putting up a dedicated website that will be accessible off the Miller Center homepage on the series that we are doing on the business of intelligence. And that will be live in the next two or three days, but it will pull together a lot of the Miller Center resources on the intelligence community. And the final announcement is that on the 15th of October at 10:30 rather than 11, we're having a special forum with Bob Bruner, who's the Dean of the Darden School, Herman Schwartz, and David LeBlanc, both of whom are in the politics department, on the bailout program that is being voted on today, how we got in the crisis, and what these people see as the solution to it. So it should be a very timely topic, and hope that you will be able to attend. Welcome to the Miller Center Forum. It's a pleasure to welcome back our good friend Frederick P. Hitz. Really, there's no one who is any better qualified and positioned to open the Miller Center Forum's series on intelligence by providing a short history of the business of intelligence. Fred Hitz graduated from Princeton University and Harvard Law School, and then went into the clandestine service for the Central Intelligence Agency, serving first in Africa. After a stint in private law practice, he returned to public service at the State, Defense, and Energy Departments before resuming his CIA career in 1978 as legislative counsel to the Director of Central Intelligence. In 1980, he became Deputy Director for Europe in the Directorate of Operations. And after a second tour of duty in private practice in 1990, he was appointed by President George H.W. Bush as the first statutory Inspector General, a position that he held until his retirement in 1998. For his service to our nation, he was awarded the Secretary of Defense Medal for outstanding public service and the Distinguished Intelligence Medal by the Director of Central Intelligence. On the occasion of Fred Hitz's retirement, Senator Arlen Specter said this in the Senate: "Fred Hitz was nominated by President Bush in 1990, confirmed by the Senate in October 1990, and sworn in November 1990. The Congress wanted a strong-willed and independent individual who was knowledgeable of CIA's mission, history, and activities, and who had the fortitude and skills to identify, investigate, and report wrongdoing when he saw it and how he saw it. Over the past 7 years, Fred Hitz has accomplished this mandate with honor and diligence in a sea of congressional and controversial investigations." Since his retirement, Fred Hitz has taught at the Woodrow Wilson School at Princeton and at the University of Virginia Law School, and has published two books, The Great Game, The Myths and Reality of Espionage, and this past year, Why Spy? Espionage in an Age of Uncertainty, that was published in May. Please welcome Fred Hitz.
Thanks, very friendly and much too full an introduction. I appreciate it, and I'm happy to see so many faces known to me, good friends and students at Jill and other places. This is a labor of love. This organization has had quite a remarkable history. We tend to think of the CIA and the Office of Strategic Services, its antecedent as the beginning of intelligence in the United States, and that really is not the case. George Washington had a fund of unvouchered monies called, there was a committee of foreign correspondents that he ran that permitted him to gather information. He was a great believer in intelligence as a military officer, and it continued during his time as president. And that fund continued for successive presidencies. Thomas Jefferson, our own TJ, used it in keeping track of what the Spanish were doing in Florida, for example. But we've never had an established civilian intelligence service. The Army and the Navy established departmental intelligence competencies during the latter part of the 19th century, and we know that Abe Lincoln was wrapped around the Western Union Telegraph Office in Washington trying to see if McClellan would ever agree to fight. But we never, as I say, had a civilian intelligence capability during this whole period, and it's important to try to figure out why. I think there was perfect support for it during a time when America's security was challenged, but there was also an undercurrent of a feeling that this was an un-American kind of thing to do, to spy. It was used, spying was used against us, even by our allies over a period of time. Britain, for example, was very cagey in the way it sought to cadge Woodrow Wilson and the United States into coming into the First World War. Buzzer Hall, who was the head of signals intelligence for British intelligence, was involved in the Zimmerman telegram episode that our history books and our high school history courses have always told us was significant in bringing the United States into regarding Germany as a nation we would have to fight. And here I'll move more quickly towards the current time. During the 20s and 30s, although we had established a fairly good signals intelligence capacity in the State Department during the 20s, it was shut down by the Secretary of State, Mr. Stimson, in 1930. Gentlemen don't read other gentlemen's mail. And that situation continued until the onset of World War II, when General William J. Donovan, the most decorated American soldier in World War I, and an enormously successful legal practitioner, one of the early antitrust division chiefs in the Department of Justice, and a named partner in his own law firm, and, as it turned out, a law school classmate at Columbia of President Roosevelt, began to agitate for the creation of a civilian intelligence agency as the war began. Well, that didn't happen, and it was not for want of the British trying to support General Donovan's efforts. Churchill, you'll remember, gave the United States access at the highest level to the product of the Enigma machine, the code machine that they had captured by, with help from the Polish, and had broken out by that time, in 1939-40, with the enormous brain power assembled at Bletchley Park in Britain, and were able to read a lot of the traffic running from the high command in Berlin to the troops. That, as I say, was shared with President Roosevelt as an indication of the importance to which he, Churchill, gave intelligence. So Donovan, in time, with the help of William Stevenson, The Man Called Intrepid, I'm sure many of you read that book, began to beef up this lobby for getting an intelligence capacity created in the U.S. The Office of Strategic Services was thus founded. And because it was wartime, it did not report directly to the President of the United States, although General Donovan, who was its head, had a relationship with FDR. It went through the Joint Chiefs, went through the Chief of Staff of the military. But it had an enormous responsibility. And this is where the impressions of American intelligence and the imprint of elitism was first established. OSS. Oh, so social. General Donovan quite rightly looked around at who would be the raw material for the new intelligence agents, and he said, surely we've got to choose people who speak a foreign language, speak a second language, speak it well. We've got to get people who've traveled, who've lived in foreign environments. A lot of lawyers on Wall Street, my colleagues are of that nature. Investment banks, whom we're given to understand are no longer going to exist. But investment bankers have had this experience. So as he reached out to try to build a cadre of operations officers, it was natural to go to the people he knew. And on the analytical side, he reached out to William Langer, a well-known professor of European history at Harvard University, to organize the academic world to come to Washington and help. So you had young scholars, postdocs, or newly minted PhDs taking leave from their assignments, if they had them, and coming down and leaving the rigors of medieval history for the business of counting ball bearing production in Eastern Germany. And they did a remarkable job. They were given credit for creating the notion of all source intelligence, and there was something to that. They brought in information from the private sector, from information collected clandestinely abroad by the new OSS spies, from embassies, from military attachés, from all sources, from academic sources, to give an analytical product to the president when he needed it. At the same time, Britain was an enormous influence on us, as you can imagine, and they taught us the tricks of the special operations executive, the daring do boys that jumped in behind enemy lines. William Colby, a later director of Central Intelligence, for example, had been dropped into Norway during the war. A number of others had had a similar experience making contact with local resistance movements. And so coming out of World War II, where nobody would have claimed that OSS necessarily made a major and material contribution to the victory, they were certainly an active part of it. And after President Roosevelt's death, there arose the question of what was to become of OSS now that the war was over. President Truman quite clearly mistrusted the clandestine service. He felt that he had enough trouble trying to keep J. Edgar Hoover on the reservation. And as he said often, I don't want to run another Gestapo. So it was a hard sell. And in 1945, he chose to disband OSS. He also, despite his distinguished career, had a bit of difficulty with General Donovan, it appears. He considered Donovan to be a rather spoiled a Republican Irishman. There weren't many Republican Irishmen out in his part of the world, and they never kind of worked it out. But times had changed, and were changing, more to the point. And as President Truman reached out, remember, he was kept in almost complete isolation by President Roosevelt about some of the most critical things that were taking place in the administration. It is fair to say that Joseph Stalin knew more about the American atomic bomb program at Potsdam than did President Truman. And so as Truman reached out to see if he could get along with Uncle Joe and they could do something about post-war Europe and the Far East, and the door was shut in his face, he began to think, yeah, you know, this is going to be a difficult period and I'm going to need to have intelligence information about what was going on. Also, the lessons of Pearl Harbor, which you'll remember, weren't studied assiduously until after the war. Just time to defeat the Japanese, and then there'd be plenty of time to look into what had gone wrong, was just coming to the fore as a subject of study, and it was clear that the United States could never afford to have a period of, have a situation where we had a total lack of warning as we had had at that time. Therefore, with help from some of his senior advisors, President Truman fastened on first the Central Intelligence Authority and then the Central Intelligence Agency. It was created in 1947 along with the Department of Defense and the National Security Council in the National Security Act of that year. And it had it had as its first focus not the collection of information on its own so much as the gathering together of information that was being brought in by the military departments, by the Department of State, and by the FBI, and presenting it to the president in an organized and analyzed fashion. In time, however, that proved not to be enough. And here is the critical thing, and I'm offering this as sort of a counterweight to Legacy of Ashes, which I know many of you have read. Tim Weiner's written an extraordinary book there, but one that the critics have concluded was a little bit too one-sided. Tim's book is really not a history of CIA so much as a history of covert action, the political actions we took in the early days of the Cold War and continued right up until the effort to drive the Soviet Union out of Afghanistan in the 80s, where the hand of the United States government was intended not to show, but where we were prepared to do anything from managing political operations, sabotage, war, whatever was needed to advance a political goal. And those are the operations that Legacy of Ashes focused on, and to be sure, a number of them did not work out as well as their originators had hoped. This is the important point historically, though, to note. This is nothing that the CIA volunteered for. In fact, the first lawyer at CIA, a graduate of the University of Virginia School of Law, opined that the 1947 Act never intended for CIA to be involved in covert action. But there was a clause in that bill that directed the CIA to perform such other operations as the National Security Council should decide upon. And that was the sort of catch-all clause that covert action sneaked through. That and the extraordinary witness of George Kennan as the chargé d'affaires in Moscow, who wrote back in 47 that extraordinary telegram describing the Soviet game plan to advance relentlessly west across the European continent to try to protect its own security as they sought it, but to communize Western Europe. It inspired the Marshall Plan, the aid that we chose, thank goodness, to give the Europeans to build their economies back up. But it also inspired the need to perform covert action operations to, for example, prop up the Christian Democratic Party in Italy or in France. They didn't have any money. They didn't have any way to raise money, but they were being contested at the ballot box by local communist parties. The Communist Party in France came out of the Second World War, as you recall, in a very strong position. They had infiltrated the resistance movements, and especially in southern France, they were strong. So we needed to do that. We had to make sure that if Marshall Plan aid was going to be landed in Marseille, that it would be unloaded by trade unions that were not communist in control and would try to sabotage the effort. And so the State Department didn't want to do that. That interfered with their diplomatic responsibilities. The military departments had other fish to fry. They didn't want to, they were demobilizing. They had a lot of mechanical problems to deal with. The Bureau of the Federal Bureau of Investigation had been brought back to deal with domestic counterintelligence questions. It was the new kid on the block, CIA, that was charged with these functions. And so important was the responsibility, it was located in another building. CIA inhabited, for those of you old enough to remember this time, these ramshackle old buildings on the Mall near where the Vietnam Memorial is. They were temporaries built during the war. There were rats running through them. I remember one jumped over my foot when I was taking my interview down there and kind of laughed. But it was close to the center of power. And so the early directors of Central Intelligence that lived in the Naval, now the Naval Surgeon's Office directly across from the State Department, were there close to the White House and State where they could consult on matters immediately and could rub shoulders at lunchtime with State Department officers and go across the river easily to meet with Pentagon people from a downtown location. The Office of Policy Coordination, which was the entity by which CIA or American intelligence was going to run these covert actions, was located in the State Department quarters. And it was run by a very illustrious University of Virginia alumnus, college and law school, Frank Wisner, whose son, incidentally, was my classmate in college. And Frank Wisner was a very clever Wall Street lawyer who had come to work for the OSS during World War II, and as he took on this responsibility to build up political parties and trade unions and cultural organs to fight the communists, needed a source of money. And he was able to, he did a little research and he discovered that there was a stabilization fund in the Department of the Treasury, which was needed to keep our currency in line with the British pound and the French franc, et cetera, moments of financial crisis, but otherwise lay dormant. He said, well, I'm going to use some of that for my covert action operations. Also, the Marshall Plan, if you'll remember it, had a requirement that donor countries paid back some of the loans that America had made to them in their local currency. What better than to have access to French francs or Italian lira that were on deposit with the State Department as the local payback, local currency payback for Marshall Plan aid, and that again would otherwise not been used. So you saw in the covert action activity a pretty good bankroll, a rather exciting mission, a mission that I would argue, as far as American intelligence is concerned, is something that we as a people, if you can generalize, fully respond to. Don't stand there, do something, make a difference. And the budget for the OPC just jumped enormously in during this period of time. Tim Weiner chronicles a number of those actions, successful and unsuccessful, in his book. As time passed, however, the President of the United States began to wonder how our boys were doing against the Soviet Union, which, after all, was the most important assignment for American intelligence. We didn't have any penetrations. We had the occasional volunteer, but the Soviets ran a very tight police state, and we didn't have the kind of information coming out of the Soviet Union that they had coming from our side through our allies in Berlin and elsewhere to prepare their activity. And the rubber really hit the road in 1948 with the Berlin Airlift, when Stalin said, hey, I am tired of Berlin being operating on a four-power basis behind the lines of occupation. I'm going to close them down. So he cut off the Autobahn traffic, he cut off the air traffic, he cut off the train traffic. And the question for the President of the United States and for the chief of mission in Berlin was, what's happening here? Are we going to see the Red Army on our doorsteps? Has the Soviet Union decided to start World War III? And frankly, with very little penetrations, very few agents in the midst of what was going on to report on this, to its great credit, the CIA looked at the numbers and said, nope, they're not coming. And the reason is quite simple. Stalin has made up his mind that until the corresponding forces are in line, in short, until the Soviet Union has an ability to believe that it can win such a war, after what they've been through from 1940 on, they're not going to take us on. And that turned out to be the way it finished. But it caused President Truman to think that we had to look again at our intelligence function and try to strengthen it. Alan Dulles and General Doolittle and several others got that assignment. And what they concluded was that the OPC ought to be lined up with the traditional foreign intelligence gatherers, the spies, the genuine spies, and shouldn't be operating on their own. And secondly, it concluded that we needed a little bit more. We certainly needed penetrations of the Soviet Union, and we had to work particularly hard on that. But we also needed a little more crystal ball gazing. We needed more estimate of intelligence. We needed to begin to take what was going on at the present time and try to look down the road. Hence, the Board of National Estimate, that's what it was called, was sought to be recreated. And the person to do this was General Beadle Smith, who had a strong relationship with President Truman, as he did, interestingly enough, he had that relationship with Truman, because he clearly did with Eisenhower, for whom he was the chief of staff during the Second World War. I've always found Beadle Smith to be a fascinating character. When he came to CIA, he had half a stomach. He'd been sick as hell, and he'd been in the hospital for ages. So he had a highly irascible temper. I suppose all of us would if we had were in that shape. He wasn't a young man either. And he was very stern around the office, and he brooked no opposition. And when he saw that the OPC, for example, was operating outside of his dominion, but his organization was being held accountable for what they did, he stopped it. You're working for me now. And Frank Wisner duly brought his group in, which created a problem, because the OPC and the real spies were working the same terrain, and they had to do it in coordinated fashion. Oftentimes, they were seeing the same people. Secondly, to recreate a Board of National Estimate, he got hold of Langer again and said, let's gear this up. It worked very well during the war. And Sherman Kent, then a young history professor at Yale, was recruited, and they began to bring things back. But to his credit and to the end of his term, Beadle Smith believed that the United States was spending far too little effort on penetrating the Soviet Union and really getting the secrets of the Kremlin, which is what they were set up to do. The result, of course, was that the Soviets were able to build an atomic bomb sooner than we had predicted. We said mid-50s. It was more like the end of the 40s. China fell to the communists without our having known it. And also, the North attacked the South in Korea. Just one Beadle Smith story. He was known to turn to a subaltern or a group advising him from time to time. And he'd say, well, everyone around here is entitled to one mistake. and son, you just made yours. Can you imagine that would what that would do for your morale? I also want to, before I leave entirely this period of the 40s and 50s, make the point that the CIA in the carrying on of the culture war, in trying to win hearts and minds, that overutilized phrase these days, was a hell of a lot more subtle than perhaps we would be today. Remember, this was before meaningful congressional oversight. This was a time when just a few senior members of the Congress knew of what money was being spent on intelligence and where, in terms of the policy, everybody was united. The game was the Soviet Union and stopping its expansion, containing it. So we were able to fund activity without a line-by-line sort of description of what everybody was doing. And the CIA operatives and the US government involved in this intellectual struggle realized that you weren't going to sell garden variety American capitalism to Europeans after the Second World War. It was the capitalists that had their view, as voters, had let them down, first in their response to the Great Depression, and then in their failure to stand up to Hitler as he built up his power in the 1930s. The only way you were going to be able to work through them is through a socialist, a leftist point of view, but one which was clearly non-communist. So the whole idea of the non-communist left underwrote all of our opinion, and we were able to find an enormous grouping of intellectuals who recognized that the role of government in these countries would be a lot greater than would be tolerated in the United States, but it wasn't going to be in the back pocket of Joseph Stalin. Let me review quickly what went on. The National Security Act of 1949 kind of fleshed out the powers of the Director of Central Intelligence, and in what made it such a unique agency, it gave the director absolute authority to hire and fire employees. None of the civil service regulations applied unless the director chose to apply them. And more to the point, and here's the thing that really gave CIA an advantage, it could spend money without benefit of a year-by-year appropriation. As you know, our appropriations process in the country is pretty well governed to the fiscal year. And for example, as time went on and we began to invest in a satellite overhead reconnaissance program, you needed to accumulate monies over a period of time to build these enormously expensive things. And you had to be prepared to replace them if by some chance they were knocked down or didn't function. You couldn't go to the Congress and say, I want a light item here, please, to repair this spy satellite so we can take more pictures of the Soviet Union. And this Section 8 authority to us CIA lawyers was absolutely invaluable because it allowed the director to seek monies and accumulate monies. For a long time, he had a reserve fund that put him in an ideal position to respond immediately if a crisis occurred and the president needed to have help in some way or another. And the result was, as I said, during the Eisenhower years when we were trying to develop the U-2 and the follow-on satellite systems, it was the CIA that could be the banker and the near-term administrator or manager of the project, because the bureaucratic hoops that you would have to go through were you to do it through Department of Defense procurement would have been too lengthy and too take too much time. Hoyt Vandenberg, a cousin of Senator Arthur Vandenberg of Michigan, was the person who brought about a number of these miracles. He was on his way up. He was an Air Force general. Air Force had just been created in 47, as you know, eventually became Chief of Staff of the Air Force. And he was the one who saw what CIA had to do, and he got the money. Well, as we moved into the 50s, as President Truman's term gave way to President Eisenhower, The theme developed in the United States that we were not going to just contain the spread of Soviet communism, but we were going to try to roll it back. And if you remember from your reading of Legacy of Ashes, it's that which Tim Weiner spends a lot of time on. That was a really feckless effort and one very costly in terms of lives, as we tried to put people over the border in Eastern Europe. They were rolled up pretty darn quickly by the Soviets, the same thing in Asia. So there came a time when President Eisenhower, as frustrated as he was about the lack of information coming out of the Soviet Union, decided we would have to go technological. And what we did then is devote monies, and this is one of the great things that I think will be important for CIA in the out years, that is that the combination of academia, the business world, and government working together tightly without a lot of bureaucratic back and forth, created for us the eyes in the sky, which we absolutely depend on now. We depended on it even more in during the Cold War, because we were trying to follow developments in the missile test ranges in Central Asia. But this was done by President Eisenhower's senior scientific advisor, George Kistiakowsky of MIT, Edwin Land of Polaroid for the cameras, and Richard Bissell, a whiz-bang guy who'd run the Marshall Plan and a few other things, and they did it. They created the U-2 and then laid in the building blocks for the satellite overhead program. The National Security Agency, which dealt with signals intercepts, had been created in the last days of President Truman, 1952, by executive order. It joined the separate signals intelligence capabilities of the military departments with the CIA one, and continued the cooperation that had existed since World War II with their counterparts in the UK and Canada and Australia. These were the ways we sought to get around the fact that we were having difficulty recruiting Russian spies. It was also during this period that the great, I call it the era of great covert actions. Iran in 1953, as criticized as that's become recently, at the time that President Eisenhower determined to remove Prime Minister Mossadegh in Tehran and bring back the Shah, it looked as if the Soviets, through the Tudor Party, were beginning to advance on Iran. So, and the map was already being colored red, so it was decided that that was a good thing to do. And in the end, after a false start, it went extraordinarily well. Guatemala in 1954. Guatemala was considered to be the prefigurer of Cuba, a communist state in the Western Hemisphere, violative of the Monroe Doctrine. It'll always be debated. There was a series of excellent studies done by a good University of Virginia politics graduate student several years ago that dealt with the fact that we didn't have much evidence that the then president of Guatemala was a communist. The only Russian delegation that had come to Guatemala on his watch was seeking to buy bananas. But nonetheless, we weren't going to take a chance, and so he was chased. The real issue was what we would do to deal with Castro when he appeared on the scene in 1958. And that, of course, led to the Bay of Pigs fiasco, followed by the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, when, thank goodness, President Kennedy had the wit to bring in more than just the inside operatives to advise him on how to react. And ironically enough, if the Bay of Pigs was the nadir of support for CIA and CIA's ability to support the government during the Cold War. The 1962 missile crisis was the high point, because there you had a combination of U-2 pictures, that which had been caused us to know that the Soviets were introducing IRBMs into Cuba, and evidence we could use and did use in the UN. We had a lot of signals interception that heard the traffic as these devices were being unloaded in Havana Harbor. But more to the point, we had the human intelligence of Oleg Penkovsky, who was a high-ranking member of the Russian military intelligence and was telling us about Khrushchev as a leader, as a character. The fact that he responded impulsively to opportunities, that the Politburo was not on his side in locating these missiles 90 miles from our shore, thought that they were vulnerable their properties would be become known and the information stolen. And he was able to, along with former Ambassador Llewellyn Thompson, convince Kennedy that maybe instead of doing with what the military quite rightly wanted to do, bomb them back in the Stone Age and end the threat that way, see if we could get Khrushchev to pull back from what he had done. And we were able to do that. Now we know that World War III was just a snap of the fingers away, because the Soviets on the island were more numerous than we thought, and they had tactical nuclear weapons which they could have used to strike Miami if that had been possible. Let me move ahead here. As you can see, this subject consumes me, and there's a lot of history. And George said I should do a concise history. Impossible for me. Vietnam was a difficult time, but what you should know about Vietnam is that the CIA got it right. There were a lot of things that went wrong, depending on your point of view, the assassination squads, etc. But the CIA had always insisted that the only way Vietnam would work out properly is if the government of South Vietnam took the burden of the fighting and was able to get the South Vietnamese to support it. And as a result, and I remember those days, we were regarded as pariahs. I remember going down to the White House with some analysts and being told by the then head of the National Security Council, you guys sit over in the corner table. We know what your point of view is, and wouldn't it be nice if you got on the team? After Vietnam, or sort of during that period, Watergate and Nixon and Allende sort of spilled out. And I want to make sure I cover this, because that set the backdrop for the creation of meaningful congressional oversight of the intelligence community. When Seymour Hersh wrote the articles during 1974 revealing the family jewels, so-called, where all the ways in which the United States has intercepted letters going to the Soviet Union over a 25-year period, the ways in which we had surveilled peace groups during the Vietnam War, the misuse of experimentation on mind-expanding drugs, the myriad assassination attempts that had gone on, the Congress having been frustrated by the imperial presidency of Nixon and the secrecy that surrounded the White House, just went to town, and we were part of the ham and the sandwich. The Hughes-Ryan Act was passed in 1974, which required that for any intelligence activity not intended for the collection of espionage information, a presidential finding would have to be made. Now, funnily enough, this particular provision, among all of them, was welcomed by the rank and file in CIA. We did not like being called, as Senator Church called us, the rogue elephants operating on our own. We wanted to make it clear that everything we got involved in was directed by the President of the United States. The Church Committee investigation, as I say, followed Hersh's revelations. It went on for about a year. It led to the promulgation of draft legislation, which would have created charters for CIA, the FBI, all the other intelligence departments. a series of do's and don'ts that would have just been ridiculous, impossible. And to his great credit, President Ford said, all right, if that's what they want, I'll give it to them, but I'll give it to them in executive order. We, the administration, the executive branch, will be able to control it. So the Ford executive order, that order which, for example, bans political assassinations, was created at that time. And it was looked over and pawed a bit by President Carter, who succeeded Ford, and by President Reagan, who succeeded Carter, and each of them made minor revisions in the executive order, but it has continued pretty much in force as it was drafted. And I think it's the way to go, in the sense that certain expectations for the intelligence community, certain things off limits, but by executive order capable of being changed by the president if new circumstances present themselves. Let me rush along here. President Carter had a vice president who had been on the Senate Intelligence Committee and on the Church Committee, Walter Mondale, and came into office really thinking that CIA was anathema, we didn't have to do it that way. Then he became acquainted with the way the Soviet Union operated in Afghanistan in particular, and changed his spots almost immediately. He, people forget, was the person who originated the covert action plans to support the Mujahideen in Afghanistan against the Soviet invasion. Reagan, of course, came in and felt as he felt about intelligence, the way he felt about the military that had been neglected for far too long and wanted to beef it up, chose his campaign manager, Bill Casey, as the director of Central Intelligence. I would say, although I like Mr. Casey personally extremely well, how could you not? He was bright as a button. He'd devour books. He couldn't speak the English language because he'd been punched in the throat sometime when he was in school, and so he'd sort of mumble and looked like he was chewing on his necktie. But some of that was extremely artful. He had a mind that got to the point. But he was thinking in World War II terms. And in addition to strengthening the agency and shepherding the covert action in Afghanistan that drove the Soviets out, he also got caught in Iran-Contra. So let me move forward and say that that pretty well took us up to the point at which the Soviet Union fell apart. It was ironic that George W. Bush, Herbert Walker Bush, person who appointed me to the job of Inspector General, a former DCI himself, when he got the con, when he came in, he was presented with two matters that he might have used CIA to help with, namely the Noriega business in Panama, and then 91, the first Iraqi attempt to break out of the box, but he chose to do it another way. So CIA was really beginning to lose its mission, and we have gone through an enormous period of transition since the falling apart of the Soviet Union. And we've been trying to figure out what our new mission is going to be. Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden supplied that answer with the bombing of the African embassies in 98 and some other events prior to that, and the USS Cole in 2000. Terrorism became the real primary target for American intelligence activity. And in the wake of 9/11, a number of the authorities of American intelligence were strengthened. Grand jury testimony can be shared. The FISA, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, gave us powers to go after terrorists. But frankly, we've gone into a bit of a dither since then. We've really not been able to make the transition to a time that we will need absolute unrivaled competence in the speaking of difficult languages, knowledge of foreign cultures that allow us to use them. And let me just finish by giving you a few stats, and it ought to open up some areas of questioning. I heard the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, General Michael Hayden, Air Force General, say several months ago when the Wisner papers were being transferred to Georgetown University that last year CIA received 130,000 completed applications to join the organization. I'm not talking about hits on the computer at the website. I'm talking about completed applications. And let me tell you, I filled out that application on several occasions. It's not something you can do in a casual afternoon. So you've got 130,000 serious people wanting to sign up. But 50% of CIA's current onboard strength has been hired since 9/11. And 50% of the intelligence analysts have been working on their specific accounts for 2 years or less. So what we have seen is an enormous experience drain. And we can talk about that. A lot of people bailed out at the end of the Cold War. I've done my time. We won. We beat the Soviets. I'm going off and make a living. Secondly, the opportunities to do security work, do security analysis, risk analysis, has grown as a profession in the private sector. So people don't have to sit around as successful case officers, intelligence officers overseas, and live on a government salary. They can do it for the privates and not necessarily feel that their activity is going to come out in tomorrow's New York Times. You combine that situation with the overall problem that all of us in this room are conscious of, that public service is hurting, that we're not getting people, the wonderful graduates of this institution in all of its departments, to go into the federal government and help in the ways that they did in generations before. We've got a real problem. And let me tell you how it shakes out in my own particular experience. I have the good fortune of teaching in the law school, third year students for the most part. I have one with me today. And they can count on a starting salary of anywhere from $175,000 to $180,000 a year. Some of them have never even been in the clerk's office of a local court, but that's what the going tariff is. If that same individual turned around and wanted to join, let's say, the general counsel's office at CIA, we could pay him 50 at most. And that's not going to change radically. So, ladies and gentlemen, sorry, George, on and on I rattled. There's plenty more war stories to tell, but it's a wonderful organization. It has been a wonderful organization. It may have lost its way in the last year or two, but the need is there. And I feel certain that under appropriate leadership, we're going to have to do something about the Intelligence Reform Act of 2004 that created, I would say, this rather a misconceived notion of a director of national intelligence. And you'll have to realize I'm a CIA old boy and we're the guys that really lost in that effort. But it seemed to me it's done what many of its critics said it would do. It's become another layer of management over top, and instead of really helping us solve the problems, it's sort of cherry-picked at some of the good assignments and taken them on. There are things we can do to adjust, but there you have it, and thank you for your attention.
We have increased our signals intelligence enormously over the past few years. And we've all seen stories about how much information the NSA and others are pulling down out of the sky and off cables and so on. Do we have the capability, do we have the resources to analyze all the data that we're pulling down? And if not, how long do you think it will take at the present level of commitment of resources to be able to analyze adequately everything that's out there.
Well, George, you always start off with the blockbuster. That's a good one. And I think for a long time, NSA, the National Security Agency that does our signals intercept work, was slowed down by the fact that communications had moved towards fiber optic transmissions that required us to go back to tapping, the old form of tapping lines at the transmission center to gain conversations that came over landlines. But as George's question assumes, most of the transmissions we're interested now are messages on the web, on the internet, and cell phone calls. And he has identified the real problem. It's not that we can't sort of suck all of this information out of the air. We can vacuum clean it up. It's a question of who will get to what important message when. And this is a problem that faces every analyst in intelligence work in our government, or in work generally. There are so many outlets out there now. Every nation, every tribal group, it seems, has its own website or means of communication. Al Jazeera has been followed, as you know, by a number of other outlets. And that's why that figure that I cited to you, 50% have been working on their current analytical assignments for 2 years or less. You're going to have somebody who's been at this stuff for a long, long time, and who knows when a blivet comes in over the screen, whether it's a serious bit of information or just something that's coming out of thin air. Not going to do that unless you have a strong basis of expertise. The nub of your question, do we have the resources now to properly examine all of the information on a timely fashion that we are collecting? I don't know, but I suspect it's a difficult chore. I remember the current director of the National Security Agency saying a year ago, when they were trying to pinpoint the precise location of Osama bin Laden, it is exactly like the proverbial search for the needle in the haystack. Those were his words.
Thank you. Very interesting talk. And you've clearly really loved what you've done in the agency. And I thank you for that, too. The Soviet Union, the Cold War, was clearly an all-consuming and critically important existential threat to us. How did you personally react and feel in 89 when the Soviet Union evaporated?
Well, I frankly did not have a different reaction from most of my colleagues, which was that it was extraordinary, that it was unbelievable. And you'll remember that CIA for a long time dragged its feet on this. We were not sure but what the forces of reaction would reach out and take Gorbachev down. His position was not unassailable. And you remember he almost didn't get back from his holiday in the Crimea to resume control. So we were naysayers for a time. We knew that the Soviet Union was in a bad way. There's been a lot of criticism of CIA saying that you didn't understand and you didn't warn us that internally the Soviet Union was as badly off as it was. Well, our job, obviously, was to follow their progress in building new missiles and weaponry that they could use against the United States. That was our primary responsibility. The ground truth became abundantly clear, though, as Gorbachev began to loosen things up, that things were not at all good. And we knew from the period of the Afghan war that the Soviets were having a hell of a lot harder time getting young recruits to go down there. The same kind of mail, I suspect, that the Department of Defense is getting today about Iraq and Afghanistan from families saying, my son's been sent to Afghanistan and his whole detachment has been attacked and most of them have died, and what's it all about, and can't you get them home? What's going on in the Soviet Union? So it was pleasure to see that the threat we had been working so hard since 1945 to try to understand and contain was at an end, but maybe it took us a little bit longer than it should have to get off one foot and get on another and start thinking about things coming down the road.
You've explained the difficulty of information overload, that the first question that was asked of you. I'm wondering, to follow up on the 2004 sort of realignment of the intelligent communities within state and elsewhere, is there more of a sense of cooperation and coordination with all of this information that we have coming in and the tremendous information overload to be able to use the expertise and the services of other agencies to better coordinate all of this information we have so that those little bits of information like the 9/11 agent out in the West said, hey, you know, I think there's a problem going on with people learning how to take off but not worrying about learning how to land, whether things like that can be more easily dealt with from your perspective.
I hope so. And I would look at one of the creations of the Reform Act of 2004 as something that it is absolutely critical that it be fleshed out and work properly, and that's the National Counterterrorist Center. And remember, that had a provenance from the late 70s of a counter terrorist nature that the CIA, it was a Director of Central Intelligence kind of organization, so it didn't get cooperation from other entities at the level we need. But the idea is very good because it gets military departments, it gets the Immigration and Naturalization Service, the Customs, the Department of Homeland Security, appropriate people, the CIA, the FBI, all around the table to deal with a given problem. There is a freighter that has left Hong Kong with a load of munitions that we think is headed towards Lebanon, let's say. What is it? How can we derail it? How can we detour it? That sort of thing. And all those specialties, all those skills, in principle, are brought together to try to solve that problem. That makes sense to me. And also the other kinds of things that have grown out of the 2004 Act, that if you're a CIA officer and you want to get to the top, you better count on spending a couple of years in the Bureau and maybe over at Defense, or you won't get those top promotions. You've got to get experience in understanding how the other half lives. But it's very hard to break down the culture of a lifetime, and that's what I try to tell my students. If you've been raised as an intelligence officer and it's need to know and compartmentation, and you've worked at the Bureau your entire career in law enforcement, and you have a U.S. attorney breathing down your neck who says, that's evidence, and we don't share that with anybody until we go to court and introduce it. You know, these people have a perfectly, they've been on that point of view for some period of time, and they're going to need very intense direction to say the ball game has changed. In my book, the latest book, Why Spy, I say the answer to this is not the military alone, or law enforcement alone, or the intelligence world as we know it alone. It's going to be groups from all of these entities working together, whether in an NCTC or something else. And that takes time. Time maybe we don't have. One of the disturbing things that's going on, and perfectly understandable perhaps, is where we have not had the resources developed to deal with all these issues at the present time, with this loss of personnel I was talking about, we've gone to the contractor community to try to get it. And a recent Director of National Intelligence study says that 27% of the jobs in the intelligence community are held by contractors outside. I think that's a hell of a big number. And I think it's regrettable. You can do it for a couple of years, but you've got to find a way to replace those temporaries with people whose loyalty is to the career service and who want to get it done.
for his service to our country and his talk here today. We thank Fred Hitz.
Thank you, George.